Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, the molecular basis of a tasty vodka, if there is such a thing, antibacterial silver nanobullets, a new electrical nicotine nanopatch, and 10 years on from the publication of the Human Genome Project, is the promise of personalised medicine about to become a reality.
We manufacture a KRAS test. If you have a mutation in that gene, then certain colon cancer treatments aren't going to work for you. Now, these are expensive drugs. These drugs can be £2,000 or £3,000 a month to take. The diagnostic tests considerably less than that, and certainly no more than £1,000. So you can see that by using a one-off diagnostic to identify the 50% of the population who shouldn't be taking these drugs, we're going to actually save a lot of money.
QIAGEN's Steve Little, who joins us later to discuss whether pharmacogenomics really can deliver what it says on the tin. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and also in this, the July edition of the Chemistry World podcast, are Phil Broadwith, Nina Notman and Anna Lucock.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Up first this month, the stuff which has become one of the world's most popular cocktail drinks. But is there any truth in the claim that some vodkas can taste totally different to others? After all, they're just ethanol and water, aren't they? Anna.
In theory, vodka is just ethanol and water, but it's produced by fermentation and distillation of grains, potatoes, sugar beets, grapes, cassava, those kind of ingredients. And as any vodka drinker will tell you, people tend to prefer one brand over another. So a team of researchers led by Dale Schaefer at the University of Cincinnati, along with some colleagues at Moscow State University in Russia.
I had to have the Russians in there.
They tried to figure out whether there might be a molecular basis for people's preference of one vodka over another by analysing five different vodka brands.
And how do they do that?
So the team looked at the structure and hydrogen bonding of the different brands using a range of techniques, including proton NMR, FTIR, Raman spectroscopy. And they discovered that while all five brands had four essential components, so they had pure water, pure ethanol, and two hydrates, they discovered that the concentration of one of those hydrates varied between the vodkas.
You better explain what these hydrates are, what this means, and what they were physically looking at.
Okay, so in this case, the hydrate in question, it's a kind of caged complex, so with around five water molecules sort of surrounding one ethanol molecule. So it was the proportion of that particular kind of hydrate that seemed to vary between the different brands.
Was it consistent? So people are saying they like a certain vodka or a certain one has a certain taste because it has more of these arrangements of molecules in it. How does that work?
The only difference that they could find between the brands was essentially in the proportion of this one particular hydrate. And in the five brands that they looked at, it seemed to vary between the different brands. So as a way of trying to quantify this or measure it, the team worked out what they called a structurability parameter. So that was a kind of measure of the vodka's ability to form that hydrate structure within solution.
Do you not think it's possible there might be something else in there too, though? Is it that when you make the vodka, something else comes over with the distillate and, A, it triggers those particular hydrate formations and they're nothing to do with the taste? It's actually, say, the other stuff that's making that happen. They're just a side effect of it being there.
It's entirely possible. I mean, the researchers suggested that those trace impurities from the distillation process could somehow be influencing the hydrogen bonding, and that leads to how the different hydrates are formed, that kind of thing. Also, different vodka manufacturers can put in different additives to a certain extent to affect the flavour. But one of the things that these researchers found were, for example, that the more hydrates there were, the less free water molecules there were. So if you had a vodka that had less of these hydrates in, it could possibly taste more watery, so people's appreciation or taste of the vodka could vary accordingly.
I wonder if this means that in future then we're going to start seeing people manipulating the vodka in order to achieve more or fewer of these hydrate structures to adjust the taste in that way, and perhaps that might then transfer onto other spirits as well.
It's possible, but I mean, there's research that's been carried out that says that people can barely tell the difference between 30% vodka and 40% vodka. So these tiny molecular variations, possibly people's palates aren't sophisticated enough to be able to detect. But you never know, they might find out that it is more important than that.
Tastes good to me, Anna. Thank you very much. Phil, let's stay with the science of the very small, but this is not quite so small. It's bacteria, and they're playing around with silver.
Yes, Chris. Well, one of the strategies that's been used to try and protect us from bacteria in terms of our fridges or plastics or whatever is to load them up with silver plus ions. But what Michael Doktich and a group from Illinois have shown is that if you grow a particular kind of bacteria in a solution of silver nitrate, it can take that silver on board, reduce it to silver metal, and make silver nanocrystals.
So these bacteria are presumably resistant to the toxic effect of silver, because like you say, people have, ever since the ancient Egyptians, have been using silver to kill bacteria because it's recognised it is toxic. So why are these bugs not dying then?
I'm not sure that that's entirely clear, but this particular strain does seem to have developed a resistance. I think they've probably bred them specifically for it.
What are they called?
Shewellana oneidensis.
So how have they deployed these bacteria then?
Well, there's two strands to this. One is the fact that silver nanoparticles are themselves antibacterial. So when the team took the nanocrystals from the Shewellana oneidensis, they found that if they gave those nanocrystals to other bacteria, such as Bacillus subtilis or E. coli, they killed those bacteria. And they were more effective at killing those bacteria than chemically produced silver nanoparticles. So colloidal silver, which is just a bare nanoparticle, or silver nanoparticles with oleate, which is a sort of long-chain fatty acid on the surface.
That's very interesting, because that says then there's something about the silver which has been added to it or adjusted, something on the surface perhaps, which is making it have that enhanced toxicity. So presumably if we work out what that is, we've got a way of making silver much more antibacterial.
Absolutely, Chris. Well, what the group did then was look at the surface of these nanoparticles, and they found an as yet unidentified substance, but they do say that it looks like a protein. That gives us, as you say, the possibility to tune the toxicity. We can tune it to be very toxic to bacteria, but hopefully less toxic to humans. The other advantage of these nanoparticles is that they're very small and very uniform in size, which is very difficult to do with chemical means as well. So from that point of view, it's a really win-win situation.
So would the strategy be then to grow these bacteria in some kind of big fermenter, feeding them silver, make these nanoparticles, extract them in this sort of functionalized state that they're in, and use them as some kind of antibacterial preparation?
Yeah, that's absolutely one of the things that these guys are saying. The implications of this is that you can't just look at nanoparticles and say, we'll classify them by size, that dictates their toxicity. They're saying very much more it's to do with what's on the surface of those nanoparticles that has a much bigger effect.
So all that glitters isn't necessarily gold. Silver's pretty important too, especially it seems when it comes to nanoparticles. Thank you, Phil. All of us can probably recall an event we'd rather not remember, but what if you could chemically wipe out a memory that you'd prefer to forget? Well, that could be about to happen. Todd Sachter.
What scientists have postulated for a century, really, is that memories are stored by changes in the strength of the connections between neurons, which are called synapses. So they were thought to either get stronger in a persistent fashion or weaker. And it's this combination of the strengthening and weakening that was due to the change that happened during the experience that would then permanently alter the network of connections of neurons that are storing information in the brain. But neuroscientists didn't know how it was that there's this persistent change in synaptic strength. And what we discovered was that there was one specific molecule, and actually an enzyme, that was persistently strengthening the synaptic connections between neurons. And because it was an enzyme, that meant that we could actually inhibit the enzyme with a drug, and that's this drug ZIP called zeta inhibitory peptide, to test the hypothesis that this molecule, which is called PKM-zeta, or protein kinase M-zeta, was the storage mechanism for memory. What we did was we basically trained animals such that they could have a memory in their brains for days, weeks, and even months. And then we gave this drug Zip into the area of the brain where we thought that the memory would be stored. And then the memories were within an hour or two erased.
So are these memories permanently missing? In other words, could you take lifetime experience memories and just wipe them away with this Zip molecule?
That's right. It's as permanent as we can test.
So what do you think it's doing? How is it doing that?
Well, it's working on this molecule PKM-zeta. It's an inhibitor of the enzyme. So the question is, how is the enzyme maintaining the memory? So what the enzyme is doing is, in that synapse, on one side, the neuron is releasing neurotransmitter. On the other side of the neuron, it's called the postsynaptic side, it's receiving that information through what's called receptors that are on the membrane of the synapse. Now, the PKM-zeta is being made on that postsynaptic side. And what it's doing is its enzymatic activity is continuously trafficking more of the receptors, twice the normal number of receptors, into the synapse. And so the strength of the synaptic connection, if PKM-zeta is in that connection, is twice as strong as normal. So when you add Zip, within minutes, the number of receptors goes back down to what it was before the memory was stored, so that the memory is gone. In addition, the Zip effect also seems to allow the PKM-zeta itself to diffuse away from the synapse. And once the PKM-zeta is gone from the synapse, we think that's really the erasing part of the memory.
So is there a way in which we could exploit this effect clinically? Because there are, of course, a number of disorders that are directly caused by people having memories that are too good. I'm thinking of things like post-traumatic stress disorder, where people get hooked on certain stimuli, which then yield various things like panic attacks and anxiety syndromes. Could we wipe out selective memories with this?
Well, right now, we don't know how to wipe out a selective memory using drugs like Zip, because you're basically going to be erasing probably the person's lifetime's worth of memory in that brain area where you've injected the Zip. Now, for post-traumatic stress disorder, one might imagine you could inject the drug in the fear area of the brain, which is called the amygdala, and that would erase all the person's previous fears.
Which sounds like it could be quite useful then.
Well, in a sense, it's probably way too powerful because there's probably a lot of important memories for fear that you wouldn't want to erase, whether they have post-traumatic stress disorder or not. The clinical usefulness of Zip might actually be in something a little bit different, which is this preliminary evidence that the Zip, if you put it into another area of the brain where drug addiction memories are, called the nucleus accumbens, that the addictive aspect of memories gets erased. So that actually might be somewhat more in the realm of possibility. And then there's also another neurological disorder called central neuropathic pain, in which a memory for pain gets set up very often in the spinal cord. And that seems to be, again, this very same process of memory, but it's not for a conscious memory, it's for this sort of unconscious experience of pain. And this is a devastating disorder because there's really no treatment and these people just have continual pain for their lives. That actually might be treatable, ironically, because we could put the Zip far away from the brain and keep a person's memories intact while hopefully erasing the sort of aberrant memory of pain that gets set up.
Todd Sagter, he's a neurologist and neuroscientist from the State University of New York in Brooklyn. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, the electrical nicotine nanopatch, and can we really tailor medicine to a person's genetic makeup? But first, how scientists have found a way to weave cells into wires. Phil.
OK, Chris, well, this is some work that's been done by Sam Stupp at Northwestern University in Illinois in the States. They've got a sort of polymer that's made from protein at one end and a long-chain hydrocarbon at the other end, and these kind of proteins are known to associate into fibrils. But what they found is that if you heat them up, you get a kind of liquid crystal phase that you can then drag out into long, macroscopic, noodle-like fibres. They also found that if they mix up cells with that liquid crystal phase and draw it out, the cells first of all survive the process, and they secondly can then proliferate. They tried it out with some heart muscle cells. They pulled out these fibres, left them for a few days, and the heart cells grew within the structure, so you then have a kind of noodle of heart cells supported by this polymer, and because they're heart muscle cells, they spontaneously generate electricity, and they had a pulses of electricity going up the whole length of the fibre.
Oh, I get it. So if you make the material and you have cells mixed in at the same time, the cells survive the process and get incorporated into this thing that you draw out, and they then can continue to proliferate and grow and connect up, and the electrical behaviour can be propagated along the length.
Yes, Chris, that's absolutely right. So the idea is that this would be used for tissue engineering and regenerating tissues where directionality is very important. So things like nerves, spinal cord, heart, where you need conduction, that kind of thing.
And is this biocompatible? Could we actually do this in the body? Or have they not got as far as to do actually doing tests on, say, animals yet with this?
Essentially, the polymer's made of protein and fatty acids, so there shouldn't be any particular reason why it wouldn't be biocompatible, although they haven't really shown that definitely.
And apart from the electrical properties, is there anything else that would come in handy from doing this?
There's no reason why you couldn't grow any other kind of cell, any other kind of stem cells or cells within the structure, so there's all sorts of things that they could use it for.
Intriguing stuff. We'll have to watch what happens with that. Thank you very much, Phil. So, Nina, now tell us about this, because sticking with Phil mentioned brain cells and nerve cells and things, there's a way of detecting where the brain is utilising glucose, and it's a step forward in what we've had before.
Yeah, so this is a simplified way of looking at the glucose levels in different areas of the brain. So this method is based on gold nanoparticles, and it's a simple colour change test, so it's visible to the naked eye. And the current method that there are for looking at this, they have problems with interference from other electrically active species, so it might not be the glucose you're detecting, for example. But in their system, because they're using an enzyme which is specific for glucose, their system is very selective.
So talk us through it step by step. So you want to know which bits of the brain are using X amount of glucose. How do you do it?
So you take samples from the, in this case, the rat's brains, and you put it into solution. The basic system they're using is a gold nanoparticle, and when that's dispersed in the solution, it turns red. If they then add salt to this, the nanoparticles aggregate and form a blue to purple solution. But if there's single-strand DNA in there, that protects the nanoparticles from sticking together, so there's no colour change. The more complex system that they're using, they also add glucose oxidase and iron to this mixture that triggers a cascade of reactions when glucose is in the solution.
So go on then, the glucose oxidase presumably attacks the glucose and oxidises it. What happens next?
Yeah, it does. Indeed, it oxidises it to hydrogen peroxide. The iron then causes the hydrogen peroxide to form hydroxyl radicals, and the radicals cleave a single-stranded DNA, so obviously that means the nanoparticles are no longer protected. So if salt is added, the aggregation occurs and you can see the colour change.
And the amount of colour change is presumably proportional to how much glucose was or wasn't there to start with?
Yeah, indeed. So you can see initially just from the colour change, but if you want to get your concentrations more precisely, you can use UVIR spectroscopy to do that.
Can you use this to do a sort of real-time monitor? So if you had a little tube going into a certain bit of the brain and you instilled some fluid to wash out a sample from that bit of brain, say continuously, so you have fluid coming in, you take some fluid back out and you analyse that, can that give you a sort of tracing on a graph to work out how that bit of brain is responding and reacting to, say, whatever an animal is doing?
Yeah, definitely you can do that, and they're hoping that through doing that they'll be able to help with things like not only just understanding the brain better, but also with things like disease diagnosis.
Thanks, Nina. When the Human Genome Project announced the completion of the first draft sequence about 10 years ago, one of the things it promised to usher in was pharmacogenomics, or personalised medicine. But what does this actually mean, and will it ever happen? Steve Little is the Vice President responsible for healthcare at QIAGEN.
Personalised medicine, it's a really quite a very simple concept. It's the idea of using a diagnostic test to identify which patients may best benefit from the medicine. And the reason it's necessary is due to the simple fact that not all medicines benefit all patients that take them. If they did, there wouldn't be any need for personalized medicine. But given that drugs only work in a proportion of the people who take them, for example, cancer drugs can work in as low as 25% of patients who take them, there's a real need to identify those patients who will benefit, and hence they'll get a drug that suits them. And when we identify the patients who won't benefit, they can either be spared the side effects or, more likely, identify a drug that would work for them.
I suppose it is a bit strange that the way we have run healthcare up until now, whereby it's the pharmacological equivalent of me walking into a shoe shop and saying, I need a pair of shoes, and without even measuring my feet, someone just takes the first thing off the shelf, gives it to me and says, these fit most people.
Well, I guess that's true, though, you know, there always has been a lot of trial and error. I mean, for example, if you have high blood pressure, you might take four or five different medicines before you find the one that really suits you. But something like blood pressure, to use that example, that's not too bad because it isn't going to kill you in the next 3 or 4 weeks. And you've got time to get yourself sorted out. But for other conditions which are much more acute or the time is more pressing, and oncology is the obvious example, it obviously makes sense to get things right first time as best you can. But I think there's some reasons why this idea, which has been around for a long time, hasn't been practiced so much in the past and is being practiced more now. And I think the main one is probably down to technology. There's things we can do now. We have a better understanding of human genetics. We have a better understanding of disease processes. And we have a better understanding of how drugs work. And that allows us to develop these assays which will identify which patients will benefit. But of course, it's no good just having a technical solution if it doesn't also work at a commercial level.
You've raised a really important point, though, Steve, which is, of course, the question of finance, especially now in these straitened financial circumstances in which we all find ourselves. Is this eminently fundable? Because we've got to the point where every single person on this planet is genetically different, and therefore they could potentially all need their own repertoire of personalised treatments. Can we deliver that?
Well, not only is it eminently fundable, it actually saves money. One of the phrases we used is better healthcare for less money. What's not to like? To give you an example, we manufacture a KRAS test. KRAS is a gene that's mutated in colon cancer. Now, it turns out if you have a mutation in that gene, then certain colon cancer treatments aren't going to work for you. So there's no point in taking them. Now, these are expensive drugs. These drugs can be £2,000 or £3,000 a month to take. The diagnostic tests are considerably less than that, and certainly no more than £1,000 and probably less than that. So you can see that by using a one-off diagnostic to identify the 50% of the population who shouldn't be taking these drugs, we're going to actually save a lot of money. And one calculation that I saw recently said that just with that one example of KRAS for one class of drugs, in the USA, the health providers had saved $350 million. So I think to answer your question, can we afford it, I think we should turn that around and say, can we afford not to do it? It's actually really good value for money, this type of medicine.
But you have picked on rare drugs that are currently used in a minority of patients that are really expensive. What about the example you gave earlier with blood pressure? Common condition, lots of possible agents on the market. How does the equation balance out then?
Well, it's a lot tougher, because the technical issues aren't so difficult, but someone's got to do the research and the development and also the clinical studies to demonstrate that this test, whatever it is going to identify which is the best hypertension medicine. There's a problem there, because most of the hypertension medicines that we take have gone generic by now, so a drug company isn't going to be really excited about doing that. So I think this is a real place where publicly funded research can have a big impact. Because you're right, for the new drugs and for the expensive drugs, the drug industry and the diagnostic industry will take care of that by themselves. But for common drugs and drugs which have gone off patent, the commercial imperative isn't there. And it's a great place to invest public health finance to identify tests which, once they are applied, will again save money.
Have we got the technology platforms that are necessary to do those sorts of tests and to identify the markers and the genetic sequences that are associated with better or worse outcomes with different drugs and therapies?
Yes, I think we have, and I think that's a change. The you know, 10 years ago, it was possible to run a genome scan. It was expensive. It was difficult. You could only do it in a very specialized center. That's all changed now. Complete sequence analysis for genome is still difficult, but it is by no means out of the question. It's quite feasible now to justify those sorts of analyses to find biomarkers for common conditions or rare conditions. So the technology is there to allow the screening for the biomarkers in the first place. Furthermore, the technology to deliver those assays, whatever they are, into the marketplace as routine diagnostics, that's there as well. The bit that's missing is the bit in the middle. It's not discovery markers that are tricky. It's demonstrating with great confidence that these markers actually work in a clinical setting, because sometimes the clinical trials which have to be done to show that these tests work can be substantial.
Now, you're coming at this from the perspective of a company which has got a massive international presence now, QIAGEN, one of the biggest biotech companies. You obviously are clear in where you see this going and how you see this fitting into the marketplace. What are the politicians and people like NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, as it was known, what do they say about it?
Well, I think NICE has been a little slow to pick up on the use of diagnostics to target drugs, because it seems to me that it's exactly the sort of thing that they should be looking at. But I'm pleased to say over the last few months, they have now announced that they are forming a diagnostic advisory committee that will advise on diagnostics in the same way that they advise on drugs. Now, we are very pleased about that because we are confident that not only do our tests improve healthcare, they improve the economics of healthcare. And we are happy that our assays will be analysed by NICE. And I'm expecting that there'll be quite a positive outcome when people look to see whether these tests really are good value for money or not.
Steve Little. Undoubtedly, one of the other fields revolutionised by the Genome Project was that of synthetic biology, which also saw another major advance recently. Anna.
This is Craig Venter and the latest milestone in synthetic biology. So we've got a whole load of researchers based at Craig Venter's institutes across the US, and they've managed to chemically synthesise a genome and insert it into a bacteria that's been able to replicate for the first time.
So go on, talk us through the technique that they used to make that artificial genome.
Okay, so there's been a couple of previous steps that they achieved a few years ago. So in 2007, they managed to transplant a genome from one bacteria to another. That was one step. 2008, they managed the complete synthesis of a bacterial genome. So now what they've managed to do is they started with the digital code that they had on the computer, the record that would need to create the genome. They then managed to build that chromosome with four bottles of chemicals and assembled the chromosome using yeast, transferred that into a bacterial cell, and that cell became a new bacterial species. So one of the key parts in this was the use of the yeast, which helped them build up the genome part by part. So they had over 1 million base pairs to begin with. They then split that down into 1,100 segments, which each had overlapping flappy bits at the end, essentially. So they popped them into the yeast. The yeast recognised those overlapping sections and joined up all the segments. So they went from having 11,000 or 1,000-odd sequences, which then got assembled into 10,000 base pair sequences, put them into the yeast, and that eventually joined all the way up, and you had one great long sequence, which they could then try and transplant into the other bacteria, and hopefully it would be able to self-replicate.
Is this really synthetic life, though? Because they had to start with a bacterial cell to which they added this newly synthesised chromosome, and that's not quite the same as saying we've created life from scratch, is it?
It's not quite the same. They deliberately started with a genome that they knew should work in nature, and they had a couple of stumbling blocks along the way. They spent months and months trying to get this genome to work in the new bacteria and had to go back, and they eventually found that it had been one mistake in 1 million base pairs in an essential gene that stopped the whole thing from working. So it was good from that point that they started from something that they knew so that they could work out where there might be an error. And the fact that eventually they transplanted it into this other bacteria, which could then self-replicate, you could argue that the parent was a computer and a natural bacteria, and then together they've made these hybrid bacteria that you could argue are at least 50% maybe synthetic biology. But it's a step, it's an important step on the way to perhaps now being able to take the information that's held on the computer, drawing things together and thinking, could we create something new with a certain set of characteristics and try and create that from scratch? And that, I think, will be the next contentious point in the story.
Well, Richard Digance famously sang My Daddy Was a Sperm Bank, but I don't think he ever sang My Daddy Was a Pentium Processor. Anna, thank you very much. Nina, tell us about this story about nicotine, though, because it looks like there may be an even better way to get smokers off cigarettes.
So this is a new type of nicotine patch. The patches that you buy in the shops at the moment deliver you a continuous flow of nicotine to help you quit smoking, obviously. And this new method is going to allow you to have nicotine on demand, which is advantageous because most smokers will go along quite happily without a cigarette for a while and then suddenly they'll want a hit. So they'll go outside and smoke a cigarette. So this is effectively doing the same thing but using the patch.
Because a lot of people say that the thing that the smokers are hooked on is that sudden spike, that surge of nicotine into the system when the smoker lights up, and that nicotine patches are destined to fail for the very reason that they're providing a low level of continuous nicotine, which kind of damps down the cravings a bit but doesn't produce that spike behaviour, which is what the smoker's hooked on.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what Bruce Hines at the University of Kentucky and his team were trying to overcome. Their system uses carbon nanotubes embedded in membranes, and to make the membranes, they embed these single-wall carbon nanotubes into a composite and then they slice them up really thinly. They then functionalise the carbon nanotubes with a high density of negatively charged sulfonate groups that make the membrane behave like an electrode. And on top of that electrode, they put a reservoir of nicotine in a kind of second electrode. And in order to get the nicotine in the reservoir above to flow down the nanotubes and into basically the person's skin underneath, they put a positive voltage across the solution reservoir on the top and a negative voltage across the membrane. And the process is electroosmosis, which the ions and the nicotine get pumped from the reservoir through the carbon nanotubes.
Is it not slightly disadvantageous that you've effectively got an electric patch, you've got a battery on it? I mean, not that you want to wear it in the shower, but, you know, that doesn't sound ideal.
Yeah, that's very true, but the battery, the amount of electricity that's required is very small, so they think they can use a watch battery and it will take, well, it will last for approximately 12 days. There are some pumping systems on the market at the moment, but they're a lot more bulky, so they're saying that this is much better because it will be much smaller. But at the moment, they haven't done any commercial development programs on it. They've just been looking at it in the basic research lab.
Nina Notman with news of the nicotine nanopatch. How's that for an alliteration? And talking of wordplays and other senseless gags, Phil, what have you got for us?
Well, I think this month's is a bit of a cracker, actually, Chris. We've got a joke sent in from Stephanie Pirri in Gibraltar, and she says, I once saw a pest control sign that read, do you have mole problems? If so, call Avogadro on 602 1023.
I'd say that's maybe an 8 out of 10 this month, not too bad. If you think you can do better, send your jokes over to chemistryworld@rsc.org and include your name and address, and you could be with a chance of winning this month's goodie bag.
Will someone please save me from these terrible jokes? If you've got something seriously funny, the email address again, chemistryworld@rsc.org. We're back with more chemical shenanigans and mayhem next month, but don't forget there's also our sister podcast, Chemistry in Its Element, which should keep you chemically entertained in the meantime. Contributors this month were Phil Broadwith, Nina Notman and Anna Lucock. The production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Until next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.